Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. This is the beginning of part two of my teleseminar with Art Hamill. Let's get going. Art, what is the best method or resource for finding all businesses for sale?
Well, you know, I don't care where you are in the world. What I always suggest, and I've always suggested from day one, is contacting the sellers of businesses direct. Now, what we normally do is in a library, I don't care where you are on the planet, there are directories. At the library, they'll actually give you the information, who the owner is and how much money they make, and usually sales. It doesn't give you net profit normally, but it'll give you sales so you'll know what category you're in. Type of business, how many employees they have, things like that, the address, email address, the whole thing. So what happens is we prepare letters that we send out. Now, if you're going to send out a letter, keep in mind that you want a letter that's basically a series of bullets. In other words, don't have long paragraphs. Just say, item one, I'm interested in buying your company. Number two, I'm willing to pay all cash, whatever it happens to be. So we have three or four things on that. And you tell them also, I'm not a business broker. I'm not a merger and acquisition person. I am not a private equity fund. And the reason you do that all over the world, these people are continually bombarding sellers of companies. And if you don't let them know that you're not one of them, they're going to throw your letter or whatever you send them in the wastebasket. So you do that. Again, in every country, there's also services, whether it's at Dun & Bradstreet or whatever, that for a fee, that will give you a printout. You just tear the labels off and put it on the letters, too. And they also will give you the breakdown of how much money they're making and things like that. But there's a lot of information out there. Now, the other source, taking it from the other side, years ago we did not have the Internet. And so even when it first started and they put together these Internet sites, the international ones, where businesses are for sale, what happened was they were almost all sellers of companies. Well, I was in the brokerage business even back in those days when we had five offices. And one of the things we always do in our Monday meetings, we'd have the brokers set up and say, okay, we want every one of you to spend at least 2 hours this week going on the Internet and getting the listings from the sellers that were trying to sell it themselves. You go on there and you tell them basically, aren't you tired of getting all these phone calls from your Internet site? We can do that for you. We can get all cash. We'll do all this other. And so what happens is the brokers have taken those sites over. The only problem you have with that, the brokers do too good of a job of qualifying you. So what happens is the average person I work with gets very irritated with these brokers or merger and acquisition people because they will question you to death. In fact, they'll question you so much that you'll eventually decide to do it my way. Now, for those of you who don't believe in doing it my way, how do you think the private equity companies, how do you think the merger and acquisition companies, and how do you think the business brokers get their listings all over the planet? Hello? They send out letters. I know, but that's the way it developed. In fact, when I first started teaching, where we had all these business brokers and things around, the reason we all ended up doing this is what I was teaching years ago, back in the old days, you know, before the sun came up on Earth. But try these things, and yes, they do work. We've been doing them that way for years.
What is the best type of business to pursue buying through investors in an economy like the one we are currently in?
Okay, you said through investors. From an investor's standpoint, the investors we work with in the United States especially, we find that they like manufacturing better than anything else. And the reason for that is most of our investors also are owners of manufacturing companies. So they're usually easier to work with on those. Now, for those of you that are coming to work with us or trying to work with us on these deals, the investors all want to get involved in manufacturing. If you want to get involved in something else like service and other type businesses, we have other methods that we use. And they're in the program that Michael puts out. So if you're going through that, you'll be able to find the other way of doing it. Because when we put together that program, we're really not working with investors. So you'll find those other techniques, which is basically a leveraged buyout. In other words, we're getting owner financing on part of it, and then we're financing the assets. Again, that's why we pick manufacturing. The easiest to do, and the owners are easiest to work with.
What type of business would succeed in a recession? What factors to consider, such as cash flow, credit line, when buying a business during a recession?
Let's talk about a recession, because people worry about this even when we don't have a recession. Or different countries around the world are in a recession. Maybe we're not in the United States, which I can't imagine. What you have to think about is just use logic on this thing. Now, what businesses do you think, or what part of the economy have the most peaks and valleys? No matter where you are on the planet, real estate. So any business that you have that's tied into the real estate industry is going to be a kiss of death, because every so many years you're going to have a peak and you're going to have valleys. So what happens is, over the period of time, you're going to make X number of dollars for so many years, and then you're not going to make any money for X number of years. You don't want business like that. The very simple thing is, you're looking for a business that has had a growth in sales and profit for at least the last 3 years. Again, that's etched in stone, for the last 3 years. If it has peaks and valleys, you don't want it. Now, if it's something that looks like real estate, we will actually ask the owners of the business, the sellers, for their sales figures and their profit figures for the last 10 years. Not their profit and loss and balance sheets, just the figures, just so that we can see what the sales and profit did for the last 10 years, to see where the peaks and valleys are. Other things that we run into, and it's in the United States or all over the world, and these are companies that are suppliers for auto industries. Okay, I don't care if the U.S. auto industries or for the Chinese companies or the German companies, they will beat you to death, because what happens is, first of all, you get an order for X number of $1,000, and you're making X number of dollars on the product. And then next time you go in and bid on it, you have to go in and bid lower. And then eventually they'll make you an esteemed partner. They all have different things, BS type things that they will refer to you as. That means in that product area, you're going to be the only one manufacturing that product for them. But because of that, you have to give them a better price. They will continually beat you to death on that price. And eventually you'll get to the point, recession or not, when you'll go into the red. Right now, these companies are in the process of going down the tubes all over the United States. Okay? Before the auto companies even go down. In fact, I read in the paper the last couple of days that the Japanese companies in the United States here are willing to work with Ford, Chevy, and Chrysler to protect the suppliers. Because if they have a problem or if they file bankruptcy, some of the suppliers are going to lose that much business, which means they'll fail, and the Japanese companies will not have a manufacturing source to manufacture their small parts. And so the thing goes round and round. The other thing you have to realize is there are businesses that you don't want to ever get involved with, recession or not, and those are clothing-related businesses. Anything tied into the clothing industry, unless you are a really hard-nosed, blah, 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 entrepreneur, you don't want to get in that business. They are tough. The competition is tough. A lot of the people in the business are tough to work with. That doesn't mean they're not nice people. It's just they're tough competitors. And again, why get into something where you're going to have a headache? Don't get into that business, recession or not. And basically, it's just basic common sense. If you're out in that world and you're looking out your window someday and you're thinking about it and say, over the last couple of years, I've read in the paper that certain businesses are having trouble during the recession. And again, you see it. The retail businesses are going down, okay, a lot of them. So you're staying away from the retail, and you're going to find the retail businesses have peaks and valleys just like they do in real estate. So what you do while you're out there finding businesses, go through a lot of different markets of different type businesses you're interested in. And what you're going to find as you're looking at these, educating yourself, you're going to find businesses that have peaks and valleys. And you're going to find that I'm looking at a water bottle company. You're going to say, I wonder if they have peaks and valleys. Well, when you're out there and you're trying to buy a couple of them, you're going to find out whether they have peaks and valleys or not. You're going to be able to see it. So self-education is the greatest thing. And again, do it on a continuous basis, and it's really a lot of fun. And you then know what businesses to stay away from. And then when the recessions come up, you will not have the valleys, and you will not have the problems the rest of them have. The average stupid buyer of businesses on this planet always buys the worst business. Why is that? I don't know. There's some magic genie out there that waves a wand over you and said, okay, go out and do something stupid now, even if you haven't done anything stupid in your life. Follow my words of advice and do it this way, and you'll find that you'll be in business, and every year will be a great year, and you'll really enjoy it. You will not have the pains that the rest of the people have, the stupid ones, which are most of the people out there. Doesn't mean they're not nice people. It doesn't mean they don't have IQs. It's just that they got carried away and got into the wrong area.
What is the first question you ask and answer when you initially consider buying any business?
How much money did they make last year? Everything is cash flow. I don't care what their sales are. I do secondarily or third on the list. But first they want to know how much money they made last year. And then I want to know how much money they made the last couple of years before that. The next thing I want to know is what kind of assets do they have, so that from a standpoint of financing, or if I buy a company, I'm in the service business and I have a used pen and an orange crate, those are my assets. It's very easy for somebody to buy an orange crate or find an orange crate and find an old pen and go and compete with me. In manufacturing, you have to buy equipment, lots of it. You need lots of inventory. You end up with lots of accounts receivable, which means a lot of people owe you money. So when you're in there and you have X number of dollars, lots of dollars invested in assets, it's very difficult for somebody or people generally to go in and compete with you. Why? It's too costly. So they go into the service businesses. They can find an orange crate and they can find a pen and they're on their way.
You're listening to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. For someone with no experience or significant resources, where would you suggest they start? For example, what size?
When I first started teaching years ago, I first started at 50,000 net cash flow, whatever you want to call it. In other words, how much money do you have left after you pay all your expenses and your loans and things like that? And so we're looking at 50,000. When I did that, which was maybe 40 years ago, maybe longer, I don't know, I've lost track. But we were doing that. I mean, people were booing me, giving me a hard time. There weren't many businesses now making 50,000. Well, it was a bunch of crap, but that's what people told me. Finally, after a couple of years, they backed off and nobody said anything anymore. They accepted the fact that there's a lot of them making 50,000. But I did this just to be ornery because I enjoyed doing it. I moved it up to 100,000 because we were basically setting the standard because we didn't have anybody really competing with us in the business of buying businesses. So since we had the majority of people going out there, we were basically setting the standard. So we set it at 100,000 cash flow. As soon as we had done that for a few years, and the last few years I was teaching, we moved it up to 250,000. So since I have not taught in a few years, the minimum that I've worked on and encouraged people on, even beginning with all the problems, has been 250,000 net. And that's after you pay manager and everything. Now, if you're going to manage it yourself and the manager's getting paid 50 grand, then the business is going to give you 250 plus the 50. But that's 250 bottom line. And if you do that, the thing you're going to find especially good, if you're not going to run the company yourself at about 250,000, you will normally have a manager that will do a good enough job so that you could be a good absentee owner without problems. If you try to be an absentee owner on a business smaller than 250 on the average, you're going to have trouble because you're not going to be able to pay the manager enough to get a good one to keep him from having to call you every hour. So our minimum has been about 250,000. Again, hell, there are donut shops making 250 a year now. It's really not a lot of money anymore.
What is your best and almost foolproof method for finding a business for sale?
It's always sending out letters. It works. Again, keep in mind, over the years, I've worked with a lot of people mentoring them, and everybody tends to go to the Internet and start working with brokers and end up with all the problems. Brokers giving a hard time and getting crummy listings and all this other. On the other hand, I had people I'm talking to on the phone that did not bother. They knew that it would be educational to start going on the Internet because you can get a lot of information, educate yourself, even if the brokers are giving you a hard time, and then eventually you end up scoring because you sent a letter to an owner of a company. And all I'm saying is that's the thing that works. Again, try all the other things. Again, when you go out, go on the Internet, use that for education. You'll contact the broker. You'll get a couple of pieces of paper off the Internet, which is some of the information. The broker then will ask for a non-disclosure document. You sign that. They then will send you a more complete package. And then from there on, they start to qualify you, if they haven't already. How much money do you have? I need financial statements. I need to know who your mother was. She's still alive or something like that. Do you have your mother's approval? It's really ridiculous. Because of this, the brokers don't sell many businesses because they kill too many deals, which is a problem. So what happens is that's good education because you're going to get a lot of information, a lot of packages within a few days and a few weeks. And then over the next couple of weeks, as you send out letters, they'll start to come in. You're going to have to gather information on those, but the sellers on the average will not be qualifying you like the brokers and the merger and acquisition people do. It's just an easy way to go. And I don't care where you are in the world. I have worked with people over the years, all over the world, and I have found nothing to be different. So if you're finding something different, you're in the wrong hole. You get up and go to another hole. I couldn't resist.
What is the three best characteristics of a good business to buy, in your opinion?
Boy, that is very simple. Thinking about that, it's not a question I get very often, but think about it. You want a business that is not tough to manage. In other words, if you have a business that doesn't have peaks and valleys, that's going to be one thing that makes it easy to manage. You want to have one that's well-financed. In other words, you have put enough money or brought enough money in, or you and the investors or whatever, have enough money on the table so you don't have to fight for making payroll on Friday. But the key thing is, can you actually leave that company again? Even if you're managing it yourself, can you leave it for more than 5 minutes? Can you blink your eye, and when your eyes open again, the business hasn't fallen apart? Can you take off and play golf? Can you go off on vacation and not worry about it? The more time you can spend away from that business and have it not fall apart is the best business that you can get. Eventually, you'll be able to put a good manager in there and only go in maybe once or twice a week or once or twice a month. which is what I used to do. Those are the key things, but you'll find it makes it better. But the other thing is, just keep in mind, if you also make sure that you get the financial information that you need, so that when you go in there, you've done your homework when you buy this business, so there's no things that come up that you didn't uncover. And what will happen is you'll have what is a dream business compared to everyone else, because the average person buying a business does not know what they're doing. And because they don't know what they're doing, they make all sorts of mistakes. In fact, I don't know what the figure is, but it is my guess that a large percent of the businesses that fail, these are ones that bought a business from somebody else, failed because they were bamboozled in the transaction by the seller or broker or both. Because I was actually going to do that, to put a book together to see what the percentage was. I never got around to it.
What were you going to do? Put a book together for what?
On studies I had made on doing that.
How people got ripped off?
Yeah, and what the percentage is. You know, I have found a lot of them because we've done a lot of consulting over the years, but I never went back to do it as a percentage to find out what it was. Because if we actually come out with a percentage, it would actually force people to go out and say, I better find somebody to mentor, or I better find information before I jump in and buy or start a business, or I'm going to really fail. In fact, when we started teaching years ago, 40-some years ago, the failure rate was really tremendous. And when we first started doing this, we brought this down tremendously with all the people we were working with, because we actually showed them what to look for. We actually showed them how to do it. And the program that Michael sells actually covers all this. In spite of the people out there that think there's no way to do this, there is a way to do it. Just follow the way that we have done for the last few years, the program that Michael has, and you'll find you will not have a problem with it if you just listen. I would suggest just follow the lead. And if you then have something you don't like, you can send a nasty letter to Michael or to me saying you were wrong. But I haven't gotten any of those letters, so.
What is one of the cheapest and profitable businesses to buy and own in Australia during an economic downturn?
You know, if I were in my office right now, I could probably go to the file and bring them out because of different people I work with in Australia. There's nothing that's really different. You can go to Australia, and the reason I know about Australia, Mike will tell you, I've worked with a number of people from Australia over the years that he's aware of. Also, even before that, we just started getting people from New Zealand lately. We've done a lot with Europe and with Asia also over the years. And again, everything is basically the same. You may find some small variations, but I always tell people, unless you go to Mars, I'm not even sure about Mars, but I think Mars may be a little different than what we have here. But other than that, businesses were all set up by people. And I hate to tell people this, but everybody's the same. I don't care what country you're in or what language you speak. Everybody sets these things up the same way. Again, I know that. We've owned businesses in different parts of the world, and we've owned a lot of them in Mexico. And I was able to get away in Mexico for 15 years, and I don't even speak Spanish.
What are the best ways to find businesses that are for sale going at under market value?
Under market value turnarounds. All I can say is if you get out there and you just go out to the market and just look at businesses and you find out what the market values are, you will find some every now and then that are down. But what you have to do is realize a lot of times when you're getting them for a better price than, say, what the market price is, a lot of times you're buying into problems. So you better check and make sure that the deal you're getting is really a deal, because most of the time it isn't. The reason the price is down or it's undervalued is the business isn't doing well. Again, I've done a lot of turnarounds in my life. Again, there's two types. It's a turnaround that you do for somebody else with their money, and then there's a turnaround that you do with your money. Now, if you're listening to this and you're saying, well, I'm a turnaround expert, my question to you is, how many have you done with your money? Probably none. You still call yourself a turnaround expert. When you buy your own, you're going to find it's a lot different. You're also going to find that the amount of money you spend to buy those and the amount of money you spend to correct the problems will be more than it would cost you money-wise to buy a good business. So why are you giving yourself all the stress and strain? I know, to have your name in the paper. So the paper will come out and interview you and said, Art Hamill did a turnaround. He is a turnaround expert. Okay, but if you did that and you followed up on all these turnaround experts over the years that you read about in the paper and read about on television or through the Small Business Administration, you then find that 2 years out, on their third business, they fail. When they fail, they dump everything they've done. Because the thing is, to have a perfect batting average doing nothing but turnarounds is next to impossible. I don't care how good you are.
I have an interest in purchasing a woman's hosiery manufacturing business. What are your thoughts on that market segment?
Number one, I mentioned before, I consider anything to do with clothing, I don't care what's women's clothing, men's clothing, sports clothing, whatever, any place on this planet they are the toughest businesses to be in. The people that you're going to be working with are the toughest people to work with. I don't mean they're not nice people. They're just very tough. They're very aggressive. It's a tough business. It's tough to get financing.
You probably need some pretty sophisticated equipment to manufacture women's hosiery.
Equipment can be the thing, but you're not going to have anything different manufacturing hosiery than you would for other type products you're going to have out there. So it's going to cost you a certain amount of money for equipment. But the thing is, if you go out and buy an existing company, what you're going to do is you're going to be able to finance the whole thing, okay, or bring investors in on the whole thing. So you're not going to be putting up a lot of money. And what you're going to do is end up, again, if you have investors, you're going to own a company that's free and clear. If you have debt, you finance different assets. And if you buy that hosiery company at market, you're going to still have about half your cash flow left on the average. This is just math. This is not magic. You still have about half of your cash flow left on the deal. And so what's going to happen is, no matter what your hosiery equipment costs, if it costs $1 million, you're going to make X number of dollars. If your equipment costs $3 million, you're going to be probably making 3 or 4 times that amount. Everything becomes relative, so you're not going to have any more difficulty or problems with a hosiery business than you would with any other type of manufacturing. I hate to say this, but manufacturing, other than the problems with the clothing industry, all manufacturing companies are basically the same. I've owned many different types. And if I didn't walk in the back from the office, I wouldn't know what they were making. I mean, they're all basically the same. And again, as you get out there and you own a lot of different companies, it's going to become apparent, first of all, that all companies are the same. And then all manufacturing companies are the same. And I've had people argue with me a lot of times and say, well, that's not true. I said, okay, let's have a discussion. I'm always trying to get a discussion going on this because I know I'm right. I'm old.
Very dark. Here's a question. All right, it's March 2009. How much should I pay today for a business versus 6 months ago?
Well, the whole time I've been on this planet, we've had market prices, market values that have not changed. And again, I started working on businesses. I started in the 50s, something like that. 1850s? No, 1950s. The market values, I have not seen a change in them. Now, there may be changes on some of the businesses that are having trouble right now in the recession we have. But normally, from year to year, with the good businesses, I don't really see a lot of difference. And the values of the companies, they don't really change that much. And keep in mind, we work on thousands of these things every year. We have for years. So if you think about it, over the period of time that we've done this, we were in the seminar business. We had 100 and some thousand people go through our program. And we gave them free help until they bought a business. So if you take that as an example, how many hundred thousand businesses or million businesses have we as a group worked on over the years? A lot of them.
What are the dangers and considerations when looking at a service business as opposed to a manufacturer? For example, an established healthcare business which needs a flow of new clients to continue to thrive.
Well, anytime you have a business that you have to go out and advertise and bring new people in, it's a tough business to be in. Because what you're looking for is a business that eventually the customers will keep coming back. And if you have 100 customers, 80 of them are return customers, or 90%, whatever it happened to be. We're in the seminar business. We started off and naturally had no referrals, basically. And we finished up after 15 years. Our rate was over 60% of the people coming to our class were referrals, even though we were also doing a lot of advertising. But service businesses are especially tough. First of all, you're going to have more competition for all the people that you're trying to sign up. So if you're trying to sign up people for the health business and you have to go out and advertise, keep in mind that there's a lot of people out there competing with you. There are more people competing with you with any other type of business because how much money do they need to get into the business that you're in, the health business? And most service business, it doesn't cost that much money because you don't have much involved in the way of assets. Now, you may have to invest money for salespeople or people who do advertising, things like that, but again, the money is not going to stay with you. In other words, you have to keep applying millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars every year to keep the same number of people coming in. And on a lot of these businesses, you don't end up with a lot of referral. And so what happens is with people coming in and competition being very easy to attain and people being able to come in and compete with you easily, eventually there's going to be a good chance that you're not going to last very long. You're going to end up going out of business. You'll be a statistic. And think about it. When I was talking to you, I was thinking about a health business, maybe exercise-type facility, a gym-type thing. They might have to do advertising and sign up people. If you just go out and think about it, if you just go out into the market right now or even last year and look at the marketplace you're asking me about, read the paper and notice the number of companies in the area you're talking about that are failing right now, okay, by category. Again, when you go through the paper, again, are not a lot of them auto-related. A lot of them are real estate related. A lot of them are retail related. So when you start to think about what do I get involved in, well, think about it. Go out and get involved in the ones that are between the cracks, the manufacturing ones. Don't go into auto manufacturing. But there's a lot of manufacturing companies out there that are doing very well.
In our current recession, how do you determine if the business owner is not selling the business due to legitimate reasons such as retirement or illness or other reasons that may tell you rather than that the recession is causing the sale through poor sales or foreclosed sales?
It's very simple. You have to look them in the eye. Years ago, when I was teaching, people would always ask us during the seminar, they said, when are we going to cover negotiation? When are we going to cover getting down there with the seller and negotiating the purchase price and stuff? And I'd get down right to the end of the class and I'd say, you didn't cover this, you didn't cover this. I said, it's very simple. The only negotiation you're going to do, you're going to make sure, first of all, the business you're going in to talk about is a business that is pretty close, in other words, price-wise, terms-wise, and category that you're interested in. So that when you go in to meet with the seller, you sit down, the seller's going to say, okay, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, I've set aside an hour for this. We have never spent an hour. What we do is we get in there, we establish credibility with the seller that we can put the deal together, that we do have the money to do it. We then spend 4 to 5 hours, and you can talk to a lot of people that have been through my seminars, and they've spent 6, 7, 8 hours the first time. You'll say, that's impossible. It's the easiest thing in the world. You start off by asking them, how did you start your business? How did you do the following? What's your family like? Where did they go to school? And what you do is you get to know each other. And if you do this over a few hours instead of a few minutes, you find out almost everything you want to know about this seller. What you have to do is keep your mouth shut. Now, a lot of people say, well, I want to tell them how great I am. The seller doesn't care how great you are. The seller wants to make sure you want to buy the business and you can pay him for the business. You want to get in there and find out about that business. So you ask questions. Again, the classic. You don't want a yes-no response. So you want them to talk. And once you start to do this, you're going to find the hours pass. And although right now you're going to say, oh, my God, I'll never do that, try it. I've never had a seller ever tell me at the end of the hour, my hour is up. And we get hungry, usually after a period of time. Somebody says, let's send out for sandwiches. Do the owners say, let's go somewhere? No. They want to put together this program. We've had brokers and merger and acquisition people in there. Have any of them ever said, I have to go? No, they don't. Because they know we're on track, we're putting it together, we're getting to know each other. And then also when you're doing this, usually after the second or third hour, is that if you're going to ask for the owner to provide financing, that's when we do it. Even if the owner said in the beginning he'd consider it, the owner has not met you before. And so the owner really doesn't believe that. They don't really want to finance. Once you've been there 2 or 3 hours and they've gotten to know you, there's going to be a good chance you're going to provide financing. Why? They know you. They're starting to trust you now. So you spend 4 or 5 hours. And again, I don't care where you go. When I was in Mexico, we spent weeks doing this, trying to get to know each other, because that's what it took in Mexico to put deals together. If you go to the Far East, I mean, the meetings over there, when you go over there on your trips, you're going 5 or 6 weeks and meeting with the people, because the people, especially in China, insist that they get to know you before they really do business with you. I don't mean for an hour or two. They really want to get to know you. Okay. You ought to consider that on the people you're working with in business. Get to know everybody. You're going to enjoy it a lot more. You also will not have to worry about the problems because usually after the second or third hour, we call that the confession time because if something has been presented that is sort of on the fence, they sort of correct it at that time. So try that. It works.
What is the best business to buy on my first deal that I won't have to be there all the time?
Well, it's very simple. Find a business where the owner has somebody else running it for them, and you're going to find there's a number of them out there that have done it right, and they may even own multiple businesses. Well, if somebody owns more than one company, you're going to find that you don't have to be there all the time. So that means that's an easy one. And there's a lot of people out there that own multiple businesses. And so on those, if they're selling off one of them, again, you just have to be aware on the ones they're selling you that they're going to be available. You're also going to find there's companies out there. I don't manage any companies. And so a lot of times we have the owners stay or buying the company. And again, if you go in and you don't hard-nose harass the seller and have a nice, peaceful negotiation for 4 or 5 hours, 60-some% of the time today, owners stay to run the company. We're also cashing them out most of the time. I forgot to add that also. But what happens is we're not harassing them. We're really becoming friends. The average owner usually is selling their business before they want to retire. And also what happens out there, business owners of something larger than a donut shop doesn't ever retire. They always think, oh, I'm going to retire. think about it. How many owners do you know that have owned businesses for many years that ever really retire? They may sell the business. They're going to retire. The next year, they're back in business again. I've retired so many times, I can't believe it. I almost feel like I'm lying, because every time I said, I'm bored, I'm going to retire. My wife will tell you it's been, what, 7 or 8 times. Michael, I think it was 6 when we started working together.
Yeah.
Now, the only people that retire, when I worked for IBM, there are a lot of people there that were planning their retirement. And so I found over the years that most of the people that end up really retired are the people that used to work for the large corporations and didn't lose the retirement program. We didn't have that problem in the past. But if you're worried about your retirement program, buy a business.
Should I buy a business related to my current line of work?
That is probably the number one question people should ask. Because how many people do you run into that like what they're doing? How many people do you run into that hate their job and hate their boss, especially their job? Why would you even think about going into that business? Most of you, if you don't like them. The key thing is to keep your mind open. Go out and find a category of business by net profit. In other words, I want a business making $100,000. I want a business making $200,000, $1 million, whatever it happens to be. Go out and look at businesses in that category. Look at every business in that category. Every type, retail, service, manufacturing, distribution, every type. Okay? And what's going to happen is, and you won't believe this, you'll end up finding a business that you like better than anything you've ever worked in. It's just that you didn't have the opportunity. All of a sudden, you have an opportunity to buy a company in that area, in an area that you've always liked. Maybe it's been your hobby, and you've always wanted to be in business in that area. Suddenly, you're going to have a business in that area, and you have a business you like. So, again, keep the thing open. Don't go out and look at businesses because you have all the skill in this area. Keep in mind, if you're in management and you're buying a business, you've been in management for a while, your management skills are going to transfer directly over to whatever company you buy. You're also going to find, buying an existing company, you're going to have people that know their job in every category. So you don't have to know the whole business. That's ridiculous, especially when you get above the donut shop level. So go out and take it easy. Keep it general. And I'll make you a promise, you'll end up in something that you never thought you'd get involved in. And you'll also love it. You'll love business. I mean, if you do it right, it's the experience of your life. I just can't tell you.
For more interviews like this, please go to hardtofindseminars.com. I use Dun & Bradstreet Million Dollar Database to find businesses to approach. They list the annual sales and not the profit. I've been approaching businesses with annual sales between 5 and 10 million, but these all seem to be owners trying to get rid of a job. How can I do a better job of targeting businesses? And then number 2, he asked, Dun & Bradstreet list the primary board members, but not the owner. I've been contacting the highest board member. They often hand me off to the finance guy. Should I be contacting finance guys instead?
Now, nothing wrong with talking to the finance guy. I'm sure he's a nice person. What you're going to find is, first of all, if you're going after million-dollar businesses, the ones below 10 million are in that category. So what we always tell people, if you're going after a business making over $1 million a year, you go to Dun & Bradstreet, have them pull up businesses that make over $10 million in sales. Now, keep in mind, taking Dun & Bradstreet as an example, people will take Dun & Bradstreet reports for earnings. I mean, they did put that out. The problem is, there is no service on this planet that puts anything out that's more accurate than the sales figure. In other words, if they say their sales figure are $10 million, there's a good chance it'll be $10 million in sales. If they told you the profit was a certain amount, there's a good chance it's not true. I've had CPAs continually refer to me years ago to Dun & Bradstreet to get financial information to use on a purchase in detail. And I would tell them that Dun & Bradstreet information is never accurate because the business owners that supply it lie through their teeth. And so I had people in my class, CPAs, people from Dun & Bradstreet, and I always say, okay, we have 300 or 400 people in the class, okay? How many people here have supplied a Dun & Bradstreet report? And almost everybody in the building would raise their hand, okay? Okay, how many people here have ever done it honestly? In all the years, 15 years, all those people, nobody ever raises their hand. The Dun & Bradstreet numbers will be good as far as the sales figures are. And don't worry about trying to get nets. You're going to have to wait until you get into the business to get those figures. Now, the problem you have with Dun & Bradstreet, something is wrong because on the business they have, there are businesses making over $10 million that are owner, other than corporations or things like that. And you're going to have to talk to them about that. If not, what I suggest you do is you go to the library, get the manufacturing directory out for your state, and they're updated every year. You can keep one. You can keep buying new ones. And in there, if they're corporations, I mean, if they're public and stuff like that, you may get a president or something like that. But most of them have the owner's name in there. If you want to contact owners, you might go to those type directories. But also on Dun & Bradstreet, and I haven't gone to them lately, but I have not noticed the problem with having to contact officers like that. Now, it may be something that the people have been harassed so much, you know, from the merger and acquisition people, private equity, business brokers. They may have been harassed so much that the owners of these companies have put these other names on there. But on these other directories, you'll find most of them are still the owners' names. So I'm sorry about the problem you're having with D&B.
Let's say you've got a student, he sends out 100 letters, and the calls start coming in. What are the do's and don'ts when those calls come in, and what should the potential buyer be concentrating on when that phone call comes in with a seller?
The only thing you want to do is be nice and set up a meeting. If you sent a letter out and you want to qualify, and let's say, I'm looking for a business that has sale over $10 million, put it in your letter. When you send a letter out to somebody, you're talking to a seller, the seller calls you back, he's going to be a nice guy, and he gets someone to sell the business. So what you're trying to do is be nice to him. You're the guy coming in with the cash. You're Mr. Nice Guy or Miss Nice Woman. And so all you're trying to do is set up the appointment. Hey, great talking to you. When can we get together? I mean, don't push anything on it. Don't say, God, are you having a good year? Are you having a lot of problems? You're going to have to wait till you get there. Any of the other things that have to do with business, if you want to know, we're only looking for a business that has been around over 5 years, put it in your letter. Do they always follow that? No. But the thing is, you get the screening out that you would normally give out if you were asking the questions at the beginning. It's a kiss of death to start asking questions to somebody when they call you back. So just set the appointment up.
That's the end of Part 2, Teleseminar with Art Hamill. Please continue to Part 3.